Hello and welcome to Let Them Eat Cake, episode 31. My name is Jack. My co-hosts are John and Ace. And what are we covering today?
Today we are going to be joined by Adam Fitzgerald, host of the Darkened Hour podcast. He's what is called a 9/11 truther, because obviously the investigating 9/11 is going to attract a lot of whack jobs. Everything that we do talk about is stuff that we have actual documents for through Freedom of Information Act requests, and it's come uncovered all through the years. And there's actually been a lot of stuff that has been revealed lately that the government has kept silent since the beginning. Before we get into that, we're just going to do three undercover stories. The first one isn't that undercover, but we just have to talk about the Israeli raid on Jenin. The jingoism is interesting.
What do you mean by around the jingoism?
Well, I'm not sure if you saw the speech by Netanyahu, but it was pretty flashy. Right here, there's a quote. The objectives of the attack on Jenin, which mentioned by the Israeli media beforehand, was to turn Jenin camp into a cemetery for terrorists.
Yeah, that's pretty fucked up.
Benjamin Netanyahu consider the Jenin camp the capital of terrorism. The security agency said the objective was to eliminate terrorist infrastructure, advance combat capabilities, including the development of rudimentary rockets.
The Israeli forces went in there with their largest force they'd ever used in that camp since 2002, so basically the Second Intifada. And they were supported by drones, and they did launch drone strikes in the camp, in the area itself. And they were confronted by local militants, the Jenin Brigade, for example. Name's pretty self-explanatory. The Jenin Brigade does receive some support from like the kind of umbrella Palestinian Islamic Jihad, or whatever you want to, you know, that's kind of an umbrella group that supports a lot of different militias in the area. They came out and they confronted the Israeli forces with guns, obviously. They also placed IEDs in the roadblocks in which the, not the roadblocks, the roads themselves that the Israeli Defense Forces armored vehicles use and whatnot. And once the Israeli forces got in there, as the clashes were going on, we're talking about conservative estimate about 20 Palestinians killed, some of them involved in the fighting, some of them just bystanders. And the Israelis, only one IDF soldier was killed on the Israeli side. And so we saw videos of Israeli forces kind of digging out where these militants were hiding their weapons and their money and things of that nature. I think they're kind of just a lot of like local kind of like young men and youth who've taken up arms and have like kind of created a very informal militia, we'll call it. I mean, what concerns everyone is that this is a very large show of force from the Israeli armed forces. And a lot of people see that as, you know, kind of adding gasoline to the fire. You know, when you have a force that large being sent to the camp in like in a period of time that we haven't seen in like 20 plus years, it is a cause for concern. The other aspect of it is Jenin is obviously like regularly raided. So we're talking like this raid was like July 3rd and 4th, right? So the other thing I do want to get into is just to put it into perspective. Sometimes militants from the Jenin camp will find ways to get into places like Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, wherever, and they'll commit attacks. It's not so much like large and funded. It's really just comes down to, you know, getting a guy who, for whatever reason, has the gall to commit an attack against civilians. The way Netanyahu's government is kind of framing it is Jenin is like this new hub for terrorism.
How many civilians have they killed and how little do they care?
To what I've seen, it is hard to tell sometimes. Conservative estimate, I think it's about 20, but we don't know if there's civilians because a lot of the people like in these camps are militants, like they have guns.
So it's the same cop-out that America uses of like military age male.
To be clear, there were large-scale protests and militant actions going on
and
at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Some people were kind of just there, like trying to block their entry because they see an Israeli truck. They don't know why they're there. they think they're there to arrest somebody, or they think they're there to demolish someone's house. I mean, naturally, when someone comes into like, and you got to realize this camp is not very big. You know, they come in there and it's, well, I'm just going to get in the way. I'm like, you know, they don't have a gun or anything, but they just kind of find a way to position themselves in the way of whatever it is they're doing.
The context of camp, just because people are going to think like tents and stuff.
Don't get me wrong. The people here are like disenfranchised, but it's been around since the 1950s. People were able to, you know, they build houses, they build shops. There's a hospital. Like it's not like a camp, like tents and like people with like clothes and whatnot. And the reason these camps were built in the 50s is because they're, grandparents, great-grandparents, whatever, got displaced due to the fighting that occurred during the Arab-Israeli War in 1948. So the UN set up a space for them to live in about, I want to say it was 1953 when they set this up. They've just kind of been living there ever since. So, yeah.
Next, in the next arms package going to Ukraine, the government has announced that they're going to be giving them cluster munitions, which has sparked a lot of controversy. I think this controversy is very interesting because it shows Russia's information warfare network, because we gave these same munitions to Saudi Arabia. They used them in Yemen and nobody said anything. Nobody really said anything about the bombs in Saudi Arabia until a guided bomb was dropped on 40 children on a bus in a public market. It just really goes to show you that people are all up in arms about cluster munitions going to Ukraine, but every time the U.S. has given these out in the past, no one has said anything about them.
Has Russia not been using cluster munitions?
That's the point. So Russia has been using them from the start. These are really controversial weapons. They're banned in a lot of countries. When it comes to arms transfers with the United States, I'm obviously really interested. I personally am against the use of cluster munitions. I think they should be just as outlawed as like chemical weapons and stuff. But
I think an important thing to note here, and again, whether or not this matters is up to the viewer to decide, but I think an important thing to note is Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. haven't signed anything.
That's exactly what I was going to say next.
Yeah. Is that a UN convention? The UN convention?
Yeah.
They didn't sign that. None of them signed it.
Mm-hmm. That's what's really important, is that it's not a banned weapon. It's totally legal for them to transfer it and use. So like another example is a lot of people say like landmines, they've outlawed landmines, especially like plastic undetectable landmines or things like that. The U.S. won't sign any of that shit either. The U.S. holds itself to a higher standard than the U.N., and this is really important when we look at and understand the U.S.'s use of weapons. Now, when it comes to something like a cluster munitions, the reason why we don't want them used and we don't want to see them used is because they end up hurting civilians way more than the target. It's statistically just the worst bomb for civilian casualties. The reason is not only because it's inaccurate and it has a cluster area, but because a lot of times the bomblets don't explode. And the U.S. is assured that they have a failure rate of like less than 5%, but these things have been sitting around since the 90s. The failure rate is way higher than they want to claim. It was the DOD, but he was just like, Ukraine has to disarm all these mines anyway. Who gives a shit? It was really interesting that like how the U.S. government just really didn't address it at all, but all the information network agents are screaming about it. On Threads, there's no mention of it because Threads is like only in like America right now.
That's really funny.
Yeah,
they haven't quite migrated over. Really funny.
Yeah. So it just goes to show you who the actual voices who are against Ukraine are. Russia. One of the worst bombings, like they bombed a bunch of civilians with a cluster munition very early in the war.
A question I have on this is like the way you see it framed a lot is, Ukraine is running out of ammunition, so we had to give them these cluster munitions. If they were running out of munitions, wouldn't there be like something you'd rather give them first? Maybe something that's a little bit more accurate? I don't know.
I think the Ukrainian strategist over there specifically would have went to the DOD and show that they have a plan to use these munitions to get them authorized, because they've been trying to get them for over a year, just like the F-16s. So there's got to be a specific purpose of why the U.S. government decided now's the time. And I don't think it's just because Ukraine is low on ammo or something like that. When are they going to get these cluster munitions, and when are they going to get those fighters? So who knows?
Right. At the same time.
And just to go back to what you were saying earlier, John, about like Saudi Arabia, I think like if we want to play like the morality game or whatever, I think the reason a lot of people may view it, which this kind of adds to your point a little bit, is like, well, a lot of what Ukraine is doing, you know, the way it's framed is it's in self-defense, and it is self-defense, right? But versus like when we gave those weapons to Saudi Arabia, it's like it's probably worse, a lot worse when we gave it to Saudi Arabia because they were doing it from an like offensive, almost in like basically an invasive position. So it was like, if anything, this isn't, you know, from a moral perspective, if you want to like play that game, it isn't as bad as, you know, some of the actors we have been giving it to, Saudi Arabia being an example.
I just have personally seen a lot of shit just from Syria and Russia's use there. So it's enough for me to just be like, I'm just totally against these things being made. I get rid of them all, don't make any more. Like if you have to drop them, at least they're going to be dropped on like militant positions and not like in civilian infrastructure like Russia does.
Well, that's an argument for it, I guess.
I first became aware of like their existence because of just seeing the shit that was happening in Syria. Anyway.
On more depressing news, Mexican journalist was killed in the state just below Sinaloa, which is interesting. The guy worked for a newspaper called La Jornada, which I guess probably means the journal or something like that. He was investigating crime and drug trafficking in this state called Nayarit, which is, as I said, just below Sinaloa. I looked up which cartel it was. It's the Next Gen cartel. So it turns out that there were notes left on the body, signs of violence. So the Mexican government is understandably pretty worried. And the Press Freedom, I think it was, said that Mexico is one of the most dangerous places for journalists as well. That being said, it's only the second journalist that's died in Mexico this year. That could have been just because of like cartel violence, but that was unclear. They didn't specify. It's kind of interesting. Not much has come up. The guy was reported missing on the 4th of July, and his body showed up yesterday
It's
specifically.
not uncommon for people to be killed in Mexico, journalists
Yeah,
especially.
and on the 7th of July, another journalist was kidnapped. But he was actually found alive, which is interesting. But he was found on the outskirts of the capital of Nayarit, which is called, had it before, Tepic. So he was, investigating crimes, the cartel crimes, and obviously they were clearly not very happy with him. It's just ongoing sort of cartel things, which I'm sure the American government's going to try and use to justify going in. As they usually do, but it's you got to give it to the Mexican journalists. Like they do, what they're doing is very, very dangerous. But you know, someone needs to do it, and unfortunately, it's not the safest. But you know, I mean, there's not much more to this story. I mean, it's
I see that it's the fourth this year.
at least. So Al Jazeera said at least the second.
Okay.
So at least second,
The other one's
equals
bodies
being
haven't been
four.
found. That's what it is.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's a common
So.
thing. Is like there's this thing that they called the soup, and these guys are specialists in just breaking down bodies, and they like cook you down to your bones. They'll bury people, dismember them, and bury them all over the place.
I just scatter their remains.
It is the extent of people that are just missing in Mexico that will probably
Yeah.
never be found.
So that says last year there was 15 media-related deaths, likely linked to the cartels for obvious reasons. So I guess four in half the year is tracking to not be as bad as last year, but you know, still 6 months to go. So unfortunately, Mexico is still doing Mexico things, but so it's like I don't know, it's hard talking about this sort of stuff because it's like, you know, it says yeah, 85% increase in press related killings under the current president.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting as well. So why do you think that would be?
Basically, under this guy, he's using the military more than the police now, but also he ran on a platform of making amnesty and deals with the cartel, and his catchphrase was "Hugs, not bullets." Even though he's using the military, like we've seen it, we've seen him, this admin use gunships on people. I think yes. This admin people shot down a helicopter with an RPG. So the military is being used more than like the police state, and sure, the military also has corruption. But if we're gonna blame the president, the most likely thing would be because of these policies of amnesty, like, and trying not to like crack down, basically. I don't know what his deal is.
But yeah, like the next gen cartel says that this area of Mexico is heavily linked to heroin and opium. So it's like, that's pretty big money. So I'd imagine that there's a lot of sort of stuff like this going around. But in February, February was the other one that was confirmed. News media death. A photographer got stabbed and beaten to death in Baja. I mean, there's not much more to this story, but pay attention to it and see if any more. Track the Mexican press deaths, I guess.
That's the thing, is like, if the right wing is going to capitalize it, they hate the media, so why would they argue that?
Why would they care? Yeah.
Yeah. So, who knows with their jingoistic rhetoric lately?
Yeah. It changes so rapidly. I guess we'll see how it approaches to the end of the election cycle.
Mm-hmm. You're going to learn the truth about 9/11, which is what we'll call this episode. The truth about 9/11. And everyone's going to be so mad because we're not like talking about how George Bush did it.
Conspiracy stuff. Yeah.
It's going to be like, this document shows that the Pakistani generals used him as a fall guy.
We get so many hate watches. Funny guys.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire, and that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own, any institution but our own.
I'm Adam Fitzgerald. I'm the host of The Darkened Hour. I'm a 9/11 geopolitical researcher. I have a YouTube channel with my name, Adam Fitzgerald. And I'm also a writer, so I do a lot of written work on Medium. And that's basically about it. I'm a simple guy.
Can you explain to people what a 9/11 truther is?
Boy, that's a great leading question, huh? What is a 9/11 truther? Well, I mean, there's different variations I've noticed over the years what a 9/11 truther is, but it usually to be believed that the 9/11 truther is somebody who is not persuaded by a government official narrative, but looks forward to anomalies and conspiracies that were not covered by congressional inquiries or the intelligence apparatuses. However, through my experience online, we have a certain percentage of people within the 9/11 truth movement that have maligned the name and the essence of what the truth there actually is, and basically became fanatics when it comes to certain fringe conspiracies that are false.
That's super interesting. That's super, super interesting, because I've only ever known the word truther as the conspiracy theory sort of person. That's like, it was an inside job, that sort of thing, where if what you're saying, if I'm getting what you're saying correctly, you're saying that these people are trying to get more factual information out of the government. That was what it originally started as. Is that correct?
Yeah. In fact, the first people that were considered truthers, or somebody who challenged the narrative, were actually the 9/11 Jersey Widows, and they never called themselves anything. They were just known as the media labeled them the Jersey Widows. And these were the women who lost husbands at the World Trade Center. And they were the very first people to persuade the White House to open up the 9/11 Commission report. And they had a lot of the public backing behind them. And so from there, you know, they had so many questions to ask, and according to them, only about 10% of their like 500 questions were answered in the 9/11 Commission and the Joint House Inquiry. There's two congressional inquiries, and they basically just over time disappeared, and replacing them and others we saw this an exponential rise of the fringe mindset that took over the movement and really destroyed it from within.
I always say that people are wasting their time with a lot of the conspiracies and stuff. And once you accept the general facts about 9/11, you can actually begin to start to actually look at the actual conspiracies. Like, there are lies, there are cover-ups going on, but it's not like explosives are planted in the building, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, there's two aspects to 9/11 when it comes to conspiracy, and that is the what happened at the World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7. And when I first started studying 9/11 back in 2006, I remember saying, my God, you know, I'm terrible at physics. Math is not my strong suit. And I've always been invigorated by motivations when it comes to true crime. I took forensic psychology when I was in college. So I was more interested in the motivations of who these people were and why they hijacked planes and what made them crash, you know, intentionally into the World Trade Center, Pentagon, Shanksville. And right around 2006-07, we saw a rise in the fringe mindset films. Loose Change, for example, is the most popular. In Plain Sight was another. So
that's
what happened
one I
was,
watched.
Yeah, well, you know,
it's
what,
a good one. I like that one. Yeah, I like that one. That one's good.
Yeah, you
it's,
know,
it's, it makes a very compelling argument about the Pentagon.
I fell for it too. Look, you know, we all came from that background of conspiracy. In fact, everybody who's involved with JFK or 9/11 or some other big, you know, event in history came from a conspiracy mindset 90% of the time. Just like atheists, you know, they came from a religious background of sorts and then they became atheists. But 9/11 comes from two factors here, and that is the physics of what happened at the World Trade Center, and then you have the geopolitics. And most of the really outrageous theories involve the geopolitics. Now, whether you want to...
I 100% agree. And sorry to interrupt you. That's just, I don't care about the buildings. I care about the people that died. It so much fits together once you start going into the geopolitics of it.
Which is geopolitics, it's specifics. Now, we don't know if you're going to believe that the World Trade Center was outfitted with bombs. We have no names to go with it. I mean, you could believe that they came down by explosives. I'm not an authority to say whether they did or not. I've interviewed, you know, a couple of people that happen to think that it did. And I don't know because this is not my area. And I, you know, I could give an opinion, but it's based on more than nothing, but just my, you know, undue opinion. The geopolitics, however, is a different story. It's much more expansive, much more confusing, and much more invigorating in terms of study. However, with that being said, we can actually put together more pieces to the 9/11 puzzles with this area, because at least we have names to go with the faces in regards to hiding information or not telling us the whole story, or people that were involved with the plot or the pre-intelligence operations about people that were monitoring these people many years prior to 9/11. You can't do that with the World Trade Center. I mean, you could blame Larry Silverstein all you want, but guess what? He wasn't there at the World Trade Center on September 11th, and you could say he's suspicious as heck or whatever, but he's not a suspect. So there's no suspects involved. And I think the 9/11 Truth Movement really concentrate on this way too hard, way too much, way too long. Meanwhile, you have fantastic revelations that just happened last week, and basically nobody covered it. I think the Truth Movement in itself has worn itself out. It lost the trust of the public because we had way too many fringe fanatics that propagated these false theories, and the public said, you know what, the Truth Movement is a joke. Meanwhile, you had good people in the Truth Movement in the beginning that tried to answer those questions, and they were just shouted out.
Why do you think that the original group, the Wise, the Widows, the people who lost people in the buildings, why do you think they faded off? Do you think it was a part of, like, they just accepted it and moved on? They got the answers that they wanted? Like, what do you think that sort of, what factors came into that?
Well, I think there's a multitude of factors. You know, I don't know definitively because I've never met any of them, but I could say from probably experience and watching videos and reading their material over the years is that they grew dissatisfied with what happened with the 9/11 congressional inquiries. They basically got shouted out by the fringe conspiracy fanatics that propagated theories they, you know, that wasn't pertaining to them. And then over time, they got forgotten about and they just moved on with their lives. They can't grieve like they did back in September 11th over and over again. They just grew dissatisfied with the I think, the nature of the truth movement overall. They weren't getting anywhere. And then with this new, you know, takeover of the truth movement, so it seems, they just grew dissatisfied and said, you know, it's over. I'm saying that through my opinion, but I happen to think that's a big case. You know, we had very good researchers in the years 2003, 2004, and some of them are the biggest names I've ever come across. Paul Thompson, I think, is the greatest 9/11 researcher on the planet. He's the reason why you have the website historycommons.org, which is the greatest catalog of information in the world when it comes to like 9/11, the World Trade Center bombings of 93, World War II, Jonestown, Oklahoma City bombing. It's a huge catalog. And they didn't have enough money to keep the site going. And now that's defunct. But he's not active anymore. You haven't heard from him in the last 10 years. Kevin Fenton's another one. He wrote the book, Disconnecting the Dots. Paul Thompson wrote The Terror Timeline, two of the most important books regarding 9/11 in history. And nobody knows about them. But everybody knows who, you know, Barbara Honegger is, and Christopher Bolin, and Rebecca Roth, who's a fake flight attendant and never worked for any airline. You know, people just believe these people because it catered to their worldviews about what they saw 9/11 as.
Well, that goes into what John says a lot, which is that people don't want to be right. They want to be vindicated. And that is very much...
Pretty much.
Yeah. It's pretty much what comes down to all conspiracies. And I love conspiracy theories, right? I think there's always truth in conspiracy theories, which is why I love them so much. And this is how propaganda works as well. It all comes from a half-truth, or like some kernel of truth is there and they've just elaborated on it. Do you think that the truth of movement, the conspiracy theory one, the people overlap with other conspiracy theories? Like you mentioned JFK, but I'm talking like modern ones. Do you also think that they're
QAnon.
The ones? Yeah, yeah, QAnon or people who buy into like the Russian propaganda from the Ukraine war, that sort of stuff. Do you think that they overlap?
Yes, actually, there's a direct connection between, say, 9/11 conspiracies, the fringe conspiracy of 9/11. To say Sandy Hook, there's a direct connection to it. In fact, most 9/11 fringe conspiracy theorists that I've ever come across, I've come across lots of them, and I've dealt with these people on a communication basis through viral media, is that they also tend to believe that nobody died at Sandy Hook. Some of these people actually don't believe we landed on the moon. You know, I made a video not too long ago. In fact, it was a live video I did. And I basically opined my thoughts about what I saw 9/11 as. And I did talk about conspiracies. And I said in the video, and I'll say it here with you, that when people looked at 9/11, there was already a preconceived bias toward the American government. And it came from Y2K, and it came from the Waco incident with the FBI. With Waco and with the Oklahoma City bombing, you had this aura of like, you know, we weren't told everything, but we won't go overboard. But there was already that distrust, especially with Waco. Waco really saw, like, we saw the FBI burn that building and so many people died. And if it wasn't for children, I think it wouldn't have been as big. But because so many children died in that building, we saw the FBI as an evil entity. And it wasn't like that in the 70s or 60s, actually. In fact, there were shows on TV that basically glorified the FBI, and you know, they were a great agency. But Waco really brought out like the beginning of this fringe mindset, and two people in particular that became really big names in the alt media consciousness and the conspiracy consciousness were Bill Cooper and Alex Jones. But we didn't know it at the time because they were nobody on mainstream yet. But when 9/11 happened, immediately, it was almost this explosion of fringe conspiracies that came out. And soon as that happened, we saw the first book, which was called Le Pentgate, which was written by a French author named Thierry Meyssan, who propagated the theory that a missile from a U.S. warship shot at the Pentagon, and that's what caused the damage at the Pentagon, not Flight 77. And people ran with that because we saw no plane debris, basically noticeable. What we saw on 9/11 was unprecedented. We never saw intentional plane crashes into buildings before. It never happened. But
that's why it's genius.
Really, and it really was. But now you really can't put too much blame on people because I fell for it. And I said, you know, that really doesn't look like a plane crash. I don't see engines. I don't see wings. I don't see tail. But if you really think about it, These planes were going over 500 miles an hour, carrying 38,000 pounds of fuel, and they were, you know, crashing into hard surfaces. What do you think is going to last? Well, we never saw that before. Four intentional plane crashes with little plane debris, and the fringe conspiracy theorists saw the government and said, right away, we got to blame them because we can't trust the government. This couldn't have happened because it was so easy to attack. And people can't get over the fact that it was so easy to hijack a plane and then crash it into the most, you know, protected airspaces in the United States. And I think it's people that wanted to blame the government and just ran with so many conspiracies, and also a disbelief in believing that we could be penetrated and attacked just so easy.
You know, Bush said, Pentagon... you know, fool me once, won't get fooled again or something. It's only going to work once.
And the Pentagon as well. My sort of train of thought when it came to this and why I kind of bought into it is like, okay, the Twin Towers, they're a civilian building. In order to justify war, theoretically, a military target would have to be hit. And therefore, it's an attack on the military, attack on the country, and bam, you've got a reason for war. But it's just not factual.
Also, just while we're in the beginning here, I'd say for anyone who's more interested, Adam has an entire channel where you can get really into detail about all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, the reason why I made the channel so expansive was that so I could touch on multitude of subjects using only prima facie evidence and documentary videos that I've uploaded over the years. On my hard drive, I have approximately 35,000 videos. So I've uploaded 3,000, and I don't know how many videos I'm going to upload, but you know, there's so much information out there. And what I wanted to touch on was basically people that were there at the time, not people that weren't there and could give me their opinion. So I dealt with evidence. I dealt with, amateur video. I dealt with eyewitnesses and survivors of people. Also dealt into the areas of how to come to an understanding of the geopolitics involved in 9/11. How does this fit with foreign policy in the future? What about Israel? What about Saudi Arabia? What about the culture? What is radical fundamentalism? How did the intelligence agencies operate? And what did they entail? How did they become involved with a group like Al-Qaeda and bin Laden? So that's what my channel is basically about. It's a historical archive of the incident of 9/11 and areas relating to it to give you a better understanding of it. And I can't, like I said in my previous video with the live video I made, I can't, you know, give you a 5 to 10 minute explanation of 9/11, it would be disingenuous. I probably couldn't even do it in an hour. But just to give you a little bit of a story, Jack and John, 2 years ago, there's a good friend of mine, Ed Brotherton, who is part of a shooter group called We Are Change LA. And basically, he got these two really big time shooters involved with architects and engineers to have a Zoom meeting with me to explain, he told me, do your best to in an hour to explain 9/11. And I said, I'll try. I did it in 52 minutes. And basically the first question that came out of the one person's mouth was, could you simplify it? And I said, I just did. So it's a hard subject when you talk about geopolitics. It's much easier to point and say, hey, did you know a third building fell? You can get a lot of people involved with that, but it's much harder to go in the street and say, hey, did you know that the CIA intentionally withheld information from the FBI at the Bin Laden issue station? You lost that person. So this is the reason why so many people go with the simplicity of 9/11, because like according to those two people, which I won't name, I know who they are, they basically think 9/11 is confusing. It really isn't. Look, I'm not an expert by any means. I don't think it's confusing at all.
It makes sense to me.
It looks confusing on the face of it. It's not. You can understand what the CIA and the FBI did before 9/11. It's really easy. You can do it. But I just go a little bit above and beyond, you know, so I want people to get a better understanding of all these areas. And then you'll get, you know, a little bit of an understanding of what 9/11 is.
It's funny, just on the off topic here, you mentioned We Are Change. I actually know them. They were very big in a lot of the Epstein stuff, which is kind of funny because this is why I have such an issue with people like Alex Jones and like Luke Rutkowski, who's a part of We Are Change as well, who I used to follow a lot. I call it weaponized cognitive dissonance, but it's basically just not believing anything that you see and having to have a separate explanation for it. And with Alex Jones, like, he's done a lot of pretty interesting stuff.
Who's the guy that wrote in a journal about when things are going to happen in the future that they always talk about? Like an oracle?
I'm not sure about that.
Nostradamus. Nostradamus got some things right too. I mean, you know.
But obviously this did happen. Like, I never got to that point where I was like, oh, it didn't happen. 9/11 was inside job. But I did know that they were monitoring them, which I'm like, well, that just seems like a failure of government. And that's the long and the short of it.
Regarding Alex Jones, I'm a huge critic of Alex Jones. And believe it or not, you know, a broken clock is right twice a day. So, yeah, here's a guy who basically goes in front of a TV and says, the government is evil. And I say, well, obviously, yeah, I agree with that. And then all of a sudden he'll go up the fringe and say, well, the frogs are gay. And then you're left with a chin shrubbing out and say, well, what the hell's wrong with this guy? But then automatically it comes you right back because he may say something that you definitely would agree with that you're not hearing on the media. However, the money-making machine of Alex Jones and InfoWars and other fringe conspiracy channels get their money from the allure of fringe conspiracies. Because when they talk about just the facts, you become a dismomer. You're forgotten about in the great, you know, field of viral media. Paul Thompson, like I said, I'll use him as an example. He's the greatest 9/11 researcher on the planet. And I don't think there's anybody even come close. He wrote the Bible of 9/11 called The Terror Timeline. The entire book is like 650 pages long, and it's all media archive. It's not even his own writing. He used media to tell the story of what led up to 9/11. And it's a fascinating book. Nobody knows about it. He's not on viral media. I can't even get in touch with him because I don't even know where to get him. Same thing goes for like people like Kevin Fenton, people like Ray Noloshevsky and John Duffy. I just interviewed them. But like these people are almost forgotten about. However, Alex Jones and Christopher Bolin and Rebecca Roth and Luke Radowski on Tim Pool's show. Oh, Jason Burmes, he's got his own show. Oh, God sakes, they get 20,000 views, 20,000 people following him, Patreon account. Oh, yeah, they talk about no planes, no hijackers. You can get the attention of many people because, like you said before, people want to make sure that they're not right, but they're vindicated. And I think that's a great quote because people don't want to really know that they're right, right? Because they're afraid of what they might find out. And I have a great, this is a great quote, and I know I'm making people sick with it, but it's what I try to live by. It's from a former JFK researcher named E. Martin Schatz. He's a forensic psychologist. And I won't go into the whole quote, but he basically says this. He says that the problem with the American people is that they're allowed to believe anything, but to know nothing. Because with knowledge comes responsibility. And people want to believe that they're responsible. So they'll believe it, but they don't want to know it. I want to know something, but I really am like directed by knowledge. But knowledge, there's a sacrifice that comes with it, is that you lose your innocence. You know, you may know a little bit about something, and that little bit about something really is depressing because most of the world and how it's directed is quite depressing. You see it on media, you see it how people react and how people react to that media. And, you know, the hidden history of what's going on with the world and that, you know, there's an obvious cover up in certain events. We're not being told. Problems are getting worse around the world. And just as you come across information that satisfies questions regarding a certain event such as 9/11, well, I mean, you know, like, well, we got to do something. But you can't do nothing with belief. You can't go to court and say, you know, judge, I believe, you know, George Bush is behind 9/11 attacks. Well, what's your evidence? Isn't it obvious?
I heard it on the internet.
Right. God's sakes, you're going to get, you know, there was a famous court case in 2010. I'll real quick. There was a woman named April Gallup. She was in the Pentagon on 9/11. And what happened was she was inside. She wasn't outside. She was inside the building. And when the plane crashed in the building, her computer crashed and she was knocked back and she was with her newborn son. And she just got back from maternity leave. And when she got out, she was helped out and she fainted. Well, lo and behold, the Truth Movement got a hold of her, people like Alex Jones and Barbara Honegger, and basically made her to question whether a plane crashed there. And she went with that story that when she was helped out, she didn't see plane debris. But she never told people that she fainted before she even left the hole, the exit hole, or part of the damage of the Pentagon.
They just did renovations and found more debris just a few years ago, you know?
Right. So the problem was the Truth Movement ran with the story. Wow, we have a person who was in the Pentagon and didn't see plane debris. Mind you, they don't care about the 100 plus so people that were in Arlington that saw the plane crash into the Pentagon. No, this person was given prima facie attention, and she went on InfoWars. She was all over the place. She went to court and sued George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, General Richard Myers for their attacks on 9/11. And then a year later in 2011, she amended a lawsuit to include the following: Osama bin Laden and American Airlines. Because she later said that even if the competing theories are true, she is still a victim of it. The judge looked at that and basically not only threw her case and called it a frivolous lawsuit, but fined her lawyers $5,000 each and said, get the hell out of here. Get the hell out. And what happened was she became an afterthought because now nobody trusted her. Nobody believed her. And she's still being, you know, she's all but forgotten about. But you could see the damage it did and basically just made a mockery of the Truth Movement, that, you know, the fringe part element of the Truth Movement. And so, I mean, it's a problem, and it, you know, they destroyed themselves from within. I think it's unfortunate they didn't have to go down this route, because if you want conspiracy involving 9/11, oh my God, I mean, I have many in the way. I'm covering right now the Shea memo, and nobody really knows about it. You know, the Israeli art student ring and the moving front companies that were involved with monitoring Al-Qaeda operatives inside the United States, illegally operating inside the United States. Anybody talking about it? No, of course not. Nobody's talking about it. So, when there's conspiracy, there's plenty with 9/11. They've asked the wrong questions for far too long.
What's the right question?
Good question. And there's many. I mean, you got an hour, right? Let me be recent. The latest revelation that came out, to me, it's the most damning report in all of 9/11 I've ever come across. It's called the Donald Canestrail document. And Donald Canestrail was a part of the Office of Military Commissions in Guantanamo, Cuba. And he interviewed ex-FBI, ex-CIA, and congressional inquiry officials about information that's classified that they've seen. And they all said, every one of them, there was 23 people involved. And it's 22 pages. But they all said that there was indeed an illegal CIA Saudi intelligence ring operating inside the United States, and they were monitoring two known Al-Qaeda operatives in Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. And it was what we all suspected for years, but we couldn't. But now with this, we can prove. And this is a damning, it's so damning to the CIA, because this is really, you know, they're not allowed to operate in the United States. So this is illegal. So that means they lied. You know, and they did lie in the 9/11 commission, and they committed perjury. Nobody covers that either. But this is really it. No, but silence. I was so mad. I remember last week I was just so dissatisfied. I questioned whether I wanted to do this anymore. And that's when I made that live video the other day. And basically, you know, certain people were telling me, you know, just don't be dissatisfied with it. And they're right. You know, this whole 9/11 run, it hasn't been fun, and it's a lot of stress, and I want something done. I really believe I have this naivety in me that, you know, we can get justice if we could just get the right attention. Russia Today did cover it and basically put this as the headline: CIA recruited two agents as operatives. And that wasn't the case. The document never said that they recruited.
Of course they would. Of course they would say that.
They're not. First of all, they're not called agents in the CIA. They're called officers and analysts. There's no agents in the CIA. And Khalid al-Madar and Nawaf al-Haqqi were not recruited for anything. The Saudis were to provide funding and logistical support to these two guys to get acquainted inside the United States and to have them collect intelligence about why they were here in the first place. And what happened was Khalid al-Madar left for Yemen in 2000, and Nawaf al-Haqqi stood, and Nawaf al-Haqqi moved to San Diego and told one Arab he rented a room from, and this Arab happened to be, coincidentally, an FBI informant for years, and said to him that he thought one Arab guy named Omar al-Bayoumi was a Saudi agent. So in other words, even if they wanted to recruit them, it would have failed anyway because the jig was up because they suspected one of their agents, you know, the Saudi agent of the GID, basically as an agent. They didn't trust him. So they weren't going to tell him anything. So, you know, so this whole thing about Russia Today and how they got the article wrong, and a lot of credit goes to Florida Bulldog. They're the ones who broke the story. Dan Christensen is the best, currently is the best reporter on 9/11 in the country. And he's often forgotten about because he writes for Florida Bulldog, which is an online publication. And there's very few left of them anyway in the country. He's the best. He brings up, you know, FOIA requests and documents that we haven't seen. And he's the one who broke the story. But a big, a damning document is this, nobody covers it. And you have to wonder, if there was a document that's somewhere out there that's said on this document, George Bush is involved with 9/11, would it get press? Because if this didn't get press, what won't get press in the future? I don't know. But it is quite disconcerting.
So let's talk about motivations on why 9/11 happened. Why do you think that they wanted to attack the United States?
Well, I mean, from the bin Laden perspective, this was an ongoing problem that goes back, you know, many years. And to put it in perspective and not to lose the audience, bin Laden actually would give a lot of media interviews before 1998 is when he stopped after 98.
Terrorist TV.
Yeah. In fact, funny that you say, I'm glad you brought this up because Al-Qaeda has a media committee called the Asahab Media. And basically, when they created Al-Qaeda, they've said that they wanted to recruit people from all around the world, Arab fundamentalists from all around the world, mainly Southeast Asia and the Middle East. In order to do that, they needed to get to the youth. And by the mid-90s, you know, with the age of the internet and communication is key, they started promoting videos.
They had magazines in a lot of countries, like Arabic language magazines. Yeah. And that had like contact numbers if you wanted to go to like Chechnya or Bosnia or Iraq or something.
Well, like the precursor to Al-Qaeda, Abdullah Azzam, like his, I think he was the biggest one. And like his magazine was just literally called Al-Jihad.
Yep.
And it might have been done by somebody else, but I always think of him on the cover of that magazine when I think about these types of magazines. And then, they were recruiting right in Brooklyn, right out of the Al-Kifa Refugee Center in Mosque.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, but they're not considered Al-Qaeda. I mean, there are some experts that
think we talk about this a lot, but the precursor to Al-Qaeda was actually a charity. So. Yeah. There's charity ties to Al-Qaeda because of that. And so that's why it gets really complicated when you get into it from there. But they shut all those charities. That's one of the first things they did is they shut all those charities down. And then some of them were allowed to open again. Some weren't.
I'm glad you brought this up because that idea came from Abdul Rasul Sayaf, who opened up a printing press in Afghanistan that wanted to press literature about providing Arabs to come to the fight of the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan. And Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who's a leader of the Hizb-e Islami Army.
We were just talking about him.
Yeah, he's a major name. Him and Jalaluddin Haqqani, the founder of the Haqqani Network, an offshoot of the Taliban, they were the biggest Afghan warlords regarding recruiting Arabs. Afghan warlords generally didn't allow Arabs into their ranks. They thought of them as inferiors, but not to lose your audience. Al-Qaeda started to make this media committee in the hopes of bringing Arab fundamentalists to the fight in Afghanistan and to basically...
You mean Islamic fundamentalists.
Yeah, right. So with that being said, regarding motivations, in 96, bin Laden created his first fatwa. And the first fatwa was Muslims to fight and kill American soldiers in Mecca, Medina, because at that time, the American military was offering providing assistance to training the Saudi military, which are basically inept, and act as a military force for Saudi Arabia against preconceived enemies like Iraq, which would come later. And so bin Laden saw this as the non-believer in the most holiest sites of all Islam, Mecca and Medina. 2 years later, he created a group called the World Islamic Union, or World Islamic Front, with Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and Ahmed Rafai Taha, who's the leader of the Gamma Islamiyah. That's a group in Egypt. And they create a fatwa where he says that you are to kill Jews and Americans wherever you find them around the world. So now they involve civilians wherever, everywhere around the world, which led to the embassy bombings and, of course, the attack on the USS Cole. And what this did was, when he created these fatwas, they basically saw bin Laden, fundamentalist world, saw him as, wow, here's a guy who is willing to stand up to the evil entity of the West and Israel. And they joined Al-Qaeda. I mean, they had a resurgence of recruits in 97, 96, 97. And they opened up more training camps with the authority of the Taliban. And bin Laden was using money from his family's construction group, which, by the way, ended in 96 because his family shut him out through the pressure of the U.S. lobby in Saudi Arabia. And basically, he spent a lot of money on the Taliban, and they basically put up with him. But after a while, the Taliban was...
That's really a great way to put it, is they put up with him.
Yeah. And this is really obvious because after the embassy attacks, Clinton shot two missiles into Afghanistan, and it basically didn't kill anybody. But, you know, the message was sent. Now there was pressure from not just from the West, but from Saudi Arabia as well. And there's a story that the director, the general intelligence director of Saudi Arabia, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, goes to a meeting with Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, and he's with other heads of the Taliban from Pakistan. And there's this huge contingent of Taliban leaders, like 1,000 people from Pakistan, in this very big meeting. And Prince Turki said to Mullah Omar, why don't you just get rid of your problem, the thorn on your side, and we hand him over to us, and then we'll deal with him and hand him over to the United States. Did you know in 1998, after the embassy bombings, that the Taliban were that close, I mean, so close to handing over bin Laden.
But we actually talk about this. We have a React video where we're talking about how after 9/11 happened, how like we're just cracking up talking about people who had to go tell Mullah Omar that 9/11 happened and bin Laden just like bombed America. And like, because, you know, Mullah Omar, he didn't listen to the radio or anything like that. He had no idea it happened. So like, just imagine being the guy who had to go in there and tell him.
We've talked about on previous shows how like bin Laden was basically just this kind of like, he's almost like the insufferable rich kid at school.
Yeah,
he's
like nobody wanted him in their country.
He's a pain in the side to all these like legit like fundamentalist groups in Saudi Arabia. And they're like, would this guy just fucking chill out?
Also, like, he was a weeb, which is hilarious. Considering
we don't know if he was a weeb. We just know that there was anime on the hard drives. It could have been his kids.
Well, he was a myth made into something bigger than what he was.
Oh,
and it's basically from the Afghan war.
He did a lot of great things as far as like construction and infrastructure. He really did help on a logistics side of things.
Right. What he wanted was the United States to be goaded into Afghanistan and to have a redux of the Soviet war. And he gave credit to Clinton, actually, because bin Laden's older son, but he says that his father gave credit to President Clinton because Clinton didn't overreact. He says, when we went to the United States, he goes, we'll have to go to the United States and goad them there. Bush's reaction was immediately invade Afghanistan. And bin Laden did not expect Iraq. He said that was an additional gift.
The way I see it is they did want to goad the United States into getting into some unnecessary wars to drum up support for them. We've talked about on previous shows about how Al-Qaeda and like ISIS are kind of accelerationist groups. They kind of see it as like they want to promote like chaos to get their end goals, so to speak. So, and Al-Qaeda especially, and I think them going into Afghanistan and them going into Iraq, more or less, Iraq maybe not so much, but Afghanistan to a degree, you could see their goals were being satisfied there. But yeah, I don't see anything necessarily wrong with that. I think they did want to goad them into like a big war, kind of give themselves even more justification to carry out attacks.
To answer your point is, you're right, especially with the Islamic State, with the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the U.S., which led to two civil wars, we saw the vacuum of the Islamic State revitalized. In fact, the Islamic State was created in Jordan in 1999 under Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. They were called, I think,
Zarqawi,
they were called Wal Jihad Tawheed or something like that. And they were just basically a ragtag bunch in a Jordanian prison under the tutelage of Abu Musab al-Maqdisi, who's considered the
yeah.
godfather of this group.
Real quick, even if you look back to like Zarqawi's history, up until he gets into prison, he's basically just like a common violent criminal.
Yes.
He's not like an extremist. He's
No, he's
just
not.
like
Right. Yeah.
he's just like a guy who, and I mean like his last name, a little cool tidbit about his last name al-Zarqawi comes from a city in Jordan that he's from called Zarqa or Zarga, like it's
Great.
pronounced with a G, and that city is just kind of known for, it's kind of known like a lot of like the slums here in America are known for. It's known for having some pretty shitty areas.
Is this
So again, it did
Bonkhead?
make, what's up?
Is this the guy with the bonk in his head? Is that Zarqawi?
Does he have a bonk in his head, Jack?
Yeah.
Swahiri is the guy with the hole in his head.
Okay.
Zarqawi
I'm just catching up.
is the Jordanian who founded ISIS.
Yeah. And
Okay.
that's kind of like a thing you got to look at if you when you look at the origins of ISIS and like it makes complete sense why they're so violent. Because it's like they were essentially founded by a guy who'd already been, arrested prior for things like violent assault, pimping, like drug dealing, drug possession,
And he was
like.
more than likely a shot caller in prison.
Oh yeah, he was 100% calling the shots. Like yeah,
So
he
he
was
already
covered
had
in
organized
tattoos at
crime
one point.
down.
Like
And
he
I think
was.
that's what's really key with
That
him.
that's the other thing too, is he was probably like. Not to get crude, but he had dudes holding his fucking pockets in prison. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, he was, and you got to think about like where the split starts is again that he goes to Afghanistan, kind of like I guess you could say win over Bin Laden
He
al-Zawahiri, and I
goes
think people.
to Bin Laden and tells him that he doesn't know anything about Islam.
Is that
Because
what he says?
yes, but he pisses Bin Laden off. Bin Laden hated him right away because he has this whole vendetta against the Shia Muslims. Bin Laden actually doesn't care about Shias, so I think the main motivation with the Ayatollah as well, right there, is also just the anti-monarchy type motivation in the Iran Revolution. And the whole goal was to get America to overreach and then draw them in to take out. And because there was this whole theory, the domino theory, where if Saddam went down, all these regimes would destabilize. And we didn't really see that. We saw like the Arab Springs, there was more of that type of movement. But as far as like Jordan destabilizing after Saddam went down, everything was kind of fine there. It was only Iraq that destabilized, and it destabilized for a long time.
Yeah, there is a narrative that kind of goes on about how the Iraq War destabilized the Middle East. Again, this is not a means to try and justify the Iraq War. It's not
It's the
justified,
most
but
protested war in history, so.
right, it is not justified. Let me be very clear what I'm saying. That what happened was not justified. But when I think about the Arab Spring, for me, it just seems so disconnected from the Iraq War. I
Yeah,
don't
I
know. What do
agree,
you
but a
guys
lot
think?
of
I think
cons a
it's
lot of
so
people who want to
disconnected.
be anti-America tie it in all together to bring this grand conspiracy of blaming it all on America, and I
Yeah, it
think it's a
just
lot
seems
stupider than that.
the motivation seems so far removed from whatever was happening in Iraq.
These people
But
also seem to be Assadists as well, the ones who commit.
Oh
Yes,
yeah, no, they
correct.
like
They
love Assad to get
they
off it.
happen to love Assad and deny
Yeah.
chemical attacks and things like that. They're conspiracy theories in and of themselves. But all those people, you can go back on Twitter before they're hired by these Russian paid institutions, and they're criticizing Assad, saying he kills his own people. 2 years later, boom, chemical attacks didn't happen because they're getting a paycheck from the Kremlin. And it's like
One
these,
thing
you can look back
I
on
did
all of
want
this.
to, I did want to ask Adam is as far as the extent of Saudi collusion happening or not happening, do you think like the Saudi government did enough to kind of warn the US about bin Laden and Al Qaeda? Do you think they could have done more? What do you think about just kind of that in general?
I think they give general information that was probably known to the CIA, but not known to the State Department. In other words, general information that basically couldn't act on it, but warned them about a very dangerous individual who's creating a group to attack the United States. I do know this, that in the early 90s, when bin Laden was in Khartoum, for example, that the CIA was monitoring him. And there was one officer in general, he's a legendary, he just passed away this year. His name is Billy Waugh. And Billy Waugh was responsible for capturing Carlos the Jackal, the infamous terrorist that was captured, I think, in Algiers. And also involved with that capture was our friend Kofor Black, the head of the Counterterrorism Center in 1999. And what happened was that Billy Waugh used to take photographs and pictures of bin Laden. And he noticed that there was a couple of notable Saudis involved visiting him and whatnot. And he suspects that Saudi intelligence knew exactly what they were doing when they were visiting bin Laden to make sure. Because if we're to believe Peter Bergen, who wrote a great expose on bin Laden, I Knew Bin Laden, which is a book based on him. It's considered, it's really a good book. And what happened was there's this backdoor deal that was made regarding bin Laden going to Saudi Arabia after the Afghan war, offering his services because Iraq just invaded Kuwait.
We'll fight them with our faith.
And what happened was bin Laden said, I'll offer the Arab Mujahideen as the front lines of defense. And the kingdom looked at him like he was nuts. And he said no, and went with the better option, which was have the United States military involved in protecting Saudi Arabia. This enraged bin Laden, but they feared bin Laden. And they put him under house arrest and suspended his accounts and took away his passport. According to Peter Bergen, Prince Turki bin Faisal, the head of the General Intelligence Directorate, made a deal with bin Laden and basically said that we will release you and give you back your assets and your passport, but you got to leave the country. By then, bin Laden sent emissaries to Sudan, and Sudan was the only country in the world that didn't have the authority to implement having visitors with passports. I mean, anybody without a passport could come into the country.
It was just to interrupt real quick, I just wanted to say that at the time, from America's perspective, the two main enemies that they have right now, obviously Iraq when the invasion happens, but they're looking at Iran and Sudan. Both of those are their number one and two threats. So they're already in Sudan. They're training child soldiers with the SPLA or SPLCA or whatever, the South Sudanese fighters. They use them in Yemen to this day. Probably not anymore. They probably cut back on that because they got caught doing it. But the United States is there. They're funding training camps right next to Sudan to overthrow that government. So there's a huge factor in, you know, what exactly were they looking at Al-Qaeda as being a fringe element that could work to their benefit to overthrow that
government. To kind of add into that, it's like people seem to forget that, like, during this reign that John's talking about, Omar al-Bashir, who was the president of Sudan up until like three, four years ago, I think, before like the whole revolution came in, he was like a persona non grata on like the level of like Khomeini. I don't think people realize that. Like, for the United States, he was pretty much as bad as Khomeini or Saddam Hussein, but maybe he just doesn't get as much attention because he was an African. Who knows? Like,
well, Africa doesn't get much of attention for anything. So yeah. I guess John is right. But nevertheless, Ace, to go back to your point about intelligence, I think Saudi intelligence had a lot on bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, and they were providing blackmail funds to Al-Qaeda so they wouldn't be attacked for having the United States in Mecca, Medina. This was actually reported by John Kiriakou and Ali Soufan later on, saying that yes,
If it was just John Kiriakou, I was going to be like that. But Ali Soufan never lied to me, so I believe anything that guy tells me.
Well, that's funny that you bring up with John Kiriakou. I interviewed him too. There are certain things you can ask these people, but you'll never get the right answer. And even if they give the right answer, you still got to worry and say, did he really tell me something that's true? And that's always the case with when you deal with former intelligence officials, you know, are they really upfront? But you can only go by what they are telling you. Some of the things they tell you, you can actually get some definitive reports on their answers with backing like other people's reports or intelligence, like central intelligence reports or other documentation that backs up what they're saying. But yeah, I think Saudi intelligence is for sure. I think really pertinent information from us. And I don't know what the reason is for, but I, you know, your guess. Because I still think that, you know, you got to understand the Saudi kingdom has about approximately, it's not known what definitive number, but there's over about 5,500 princes in the kingdom from seven different families. And they're called the Saudi Seven. These are the seven sons of the original founder of Saudi Arabia, Ibn Saud. So you have 5,500 people involved with the kingdom. And when bin Laden was alive, and when he was in Khartoum and later in Afghanistan, there were certain Saudi princes that still sympathized with bin Laden and that they hated the United States. So I'll be remiss if I said
two that Pakistani generals were fired because they went to Mullah Omar and they told him not to give up bin Laden and to fight the Americans instead. And they convinced him.
It's a problem. Like, this is a big problem within, like, countries that have this Salafi mindset, like a Pakistan or Saudi Arabia. And what happens is you get these fanatics in government. I think the whole ISI is fanatical. You can't trust them. CIA even doesn't trust them. So that, what does that tell you?
What would you say, like, not to strain too much for the topic here, but we've talked about kind of like extremist religious mindsets in the ISI. Do you think the ISI was inherently like this from its founding, or do you think it was maybe like factors based on who was president at the time? Because we kind of know like Ziaul Huq.
It's all, that's how, you got it. It's all his fault.
Right. I feel like that's kind of easy to say, but maybe there's a little bit more context there. If you know anything about that,
Dude committed a genocide, passed amendments to like outlaw other religions. Dude was a fanatic. He was a psychopath.
There's also like Yahya Khan.
He also nuclearized Pakistan. And that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the Soviets invading and us needing, because that's just his condition, is we needed to go through the ISI and him to help the Mujahideen. And because of that condition, Pakistan is now a nuclear state. It's a direct link.
Yeah, I think this is a great point that you raised too. And it goes back to Ace's question about the ISI. You know, Ziaul Haq, one of the very first people he dealt with before even the war even happened, was Jalaluddin Haqqani. It was Ziaul Haq directing operations to Jalaluddin Haqqani that brought about this Arab fundamentalist groups and individuals all around the world to engage in this war with the Soviets through the help of the ISI. And I think from this point forward, we saw the ISI morph from this very nefarious and shadowy agency to a very fundamentalist sect that overtook the entire agency in time.
Continuing with the ISI a little bit, so we know that there's a bit of a distinct difference between like the Taliban that you hear about in Afghanistan and the Taliban that you hear about in Pakistan. How would you say the ISI's relationship differs between the two, if at all?
The ISI doesn't like the Pakistan one.
They
on the other hand, they back the Taliban and help them take over the country.
They
so
did
that's
a hit
the
job
difference.
Like a year ago on the head of one of the Pakistani Taliban. That was about a year ago. They did a pretty major hit job on one of them.
They saw them as a hindrance. Whereas, you know, the Taliban groups, like the Haqqani network, for example, are directly funded by the ISI. There's another individual that you know of. I know all three of you know of the name Omar Saeed Sheikh. Omar Saeed Sheikh was directly from the ISI. He was trained and funded by the ISI from the outset. And basically, he's like a private contractor terrorist of sorts and doesn't engage with a certain group. He works with other groups around the world involved with terrorism. I guess he just got released out of prison, I think, for his role in the murder of Daniel Pearl.
There was a lot of people. And I think there's a like a movie even about him called Omerta.
Yeah, so that's right.
He's like a fall guy for those generals.
Yeah, he is. And he's a perfect fall guy. You could just blame the one guy. But yeah, I think when it comes to the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan, You know, it's funny because that's the irony, right? Is that the ISI has better control of the Taliban in Afghanistan than they do in Pakistan. That goes to show you that there's a problem within, you know, the country's government and the ISI and the Taliban itself. You know, it's alleged that the ISI created a fundamentalist group.
Well, Pakistan politics are confusing. None of them make sense. Pakistan is like, I don't even know where to start with their politics. You know,
well,
like, it's insane.
I agree with you because when I wrote the article, it drove me mad because I, you know, when it came to after 2001, Pakistan basically dissolved into this authoritarian Wahhabi ideology that's intertwined, but basically they're at war with each other and basically a fight for this good. And it just basically comes down to distrust within each other. And I blame that on the ISI itself because after Hamid Gul, it basically delved into this intelligence agency that delved within the Wahhabi structure and Wahhabi militants. And you can't trust a Wahhabi militant group because basically they may one day you might be funding them, but then one day they may consider you the enemy. So, I Pakistan is a very confusing country itself. You're correct about that.
Okay, so let's wrap with something going back to 9/11. The pages that were redacted from the commission report, isn't it 8 pages?
Regarding the joint inquiry report that has this blank 28 pages that was redacted from public view, which shows that later on when it was unredacted, it was declassified under the Obama administration, when it talks about Saudi financing to certain Saudi intelligence and certain...
This was the big conspiracy for years. Everything was focused on what's in those 28 pages. So...
You had a couple of senators, one of them being Walter Jones, I think in the Midwest somewhere. I forgot his name. But he basically was instrumental in getting the Obama administration to declassify certain parts of the 28 pages. And Bob Graham, the co-chair of the Joint House Inquiry, basically said he saw the declassified version of it. And he says that they couldn't basically declassify it because it would shame the U.S. government. It shows that the U.S. government basically knew about Saudi officials inside the United States that were basically involved with financing of certain al-Qaeda operatives involved with 9/11, basically Khalid al-Badr and Nawaf al-Hazmi. And the Saudi intelligence agencies that were involved were Omar al-Bayoumi, Osama bin Laden, Fahad al-Thumairi, and one big name that was redacted for years until recently, Mu'assad al-Jarrah. No relation to hijacker Ziad al-Jarrah. Mu'assad al-Jarrah actually was a high-level Saudi official working out of Washington, D.C., head of the Saudi Ministry of Affairs. And basically, he was the person that got Fahad al-Thumairi a job as an imam at the King Fahd Mosque in Los Angeles that got Khalid al-Badr and Nawaf al-Hazmi coordinated inside the United States and then coordinated with a mosque inside San Diego headed by Anwar al-Awlaki, a Yemeni, who basically we killed.
Yeah, I was about to say, he's an important guy.
Yeah, oh my gosh, Anwar al-Awlaki. Do you guys want to get started on him?
I don't know. We're getting wrapped up here. We've talked about him many times. So.
Yeah, Mu'assad al-Jarrah was responsible for having Omar al-Bayoumi, Anwar al-Awlaki, and Fahad al-Thumairi involved with these two al-Qaeda operatives, known al-Qaeda operatives. They were known to Saudi intelligence, U.S. intelligence, and we think Israeli intelligence, but we're not sure. But the fact is those 28 pages show that there was direct funding from Saudi intelligence to these hijackers and that the CIA knew about it too.
And that was kind of the theory from the start, the main theory that people believed.
Sure.
I think John Kiriakou, before it was even declassified, said that's what was in there.
Maybe I'm not.
I don't want to quote him, though. I don't want to quote him, though, but I think I may have heard it from him. But I heard a lot about those pages back in the day.
But John, you're right. The big conspiracy for a couple of years was those 28 pages. And so go ahead.
Yeah, would you say that based on that information, we basically know that there were Saudi officials who were more or less like kind of helping with the logistics aspect of these hijackers or funding them or in some way or another, financing them?
They probably didn't know about the attack.
Oh, they didn't. But like, based on that information, do you think the whole lawsuit, when it was the victims of the families of 9/11 versus Saudi Arabia, do you think that would have, that lawsuit would have been winnable with that information, or if it even made sense to begin with? Like, what do you?
Okay, let me give you an updated answer to that. So we've had an FBI investigation into Saudi involvement with 9/11. It was called Pent Bomb. And then that ended. And when that ended, there was another operation from former FBI agents involved with Pent Bomb that said that, you know, there wasn't a lot of questions answered. So they created another operation called Operation Encore. And this was really important because what they uncovered was that there was officials within the Saudi government that had logistical support for these two hijackers. For example, when Omar al-Bayoumi was interrogated by British intelligence at his home in Great Britain, one thing that Operation Encore uncovered was that there was a notebook that was found in this home. And in the notebook was outlines of airplanes, altitudes, speed theories. And of course, there was an outline of the directions of the Pentagon in this notebook. And this should have been, you know, the death knell of the Saudi government, because this information was forwarded to two law firms that were involved with the involvement of suing the Saudi Arabian government, Creedle and Creedler and Motley Rice. So Creedle and Creedler, which was given, you know, they're the big law firm involved with this. They had this information. They have it at their disposal. All this information from Pent Bomb and Operation Encore. Okay. And still the U.S. government is protecting their interest in Saudi Arabia, saying that this information basically doesn't show that the Saudis knew about the, or having foreknowledge about the 9/11 attacks. Well, I would suggest to you that they certainly did. At some level, they did. I'm not blaming the, you know, Crown Prince Salman or his father, King Salman, or King Fahd even, the king before Salman. What I'm saying is that you do have certain people within the Saudi government that have information at their disposal that show that they were providing logistical support to some of the 9/11 hijackers. Another example of Operation Encore is this. This is a direct connection showing Saudi government officials involved with the 9/11 hijackers. What does this mean? Does this mean that they were involved in foreknowledge of the? We don't know. But the American government continues to, even with all this information, continues to protect Saudi government. Revelations shown in those Encore files are remarkable in its own right. But yet the U.S. government continues. The Biden administration, Obama administration, Bush, Trump administration, all still protecting the Saudi government in, you know, in hindering evidence regarding logistical support.
So Jack asked, what's your, you know, what 9/11 conspiracy is your favorite or has the most credence to wrap up here?
Boy, that's a good question, man.
You can even pick one that you think is the most fun. Like, if you want to talk about people who believe in holograms, whatever.
Oh, you're talking about fringe conspiracy
theories? No. I'm just saying in general. You can take this however way you want, whatever your favorite story
is. I'll tell you right now, the most interesting conspiracy, and which is the most taboo of all, and the most maligned, the most confused, and most often misrepresented, is the Israeli intelligence aspect of 9/11. When you talk about Israel, it's automatically taboo because, you know, right away, you can't talk about, you know, the strongest allies in the United States regarding the West. But it's also the most mysterious involving of all the conspiracies because there's so little information. And so I'm currently doing a video series about the Gerald Shea Memorandum. Have you ever heard of it? Nobody's ever heard of it.
Can't say that I have.
It's amazing. So there is this retired former corporate lawyer named Gerald Shea, who on his own dime took to it the initiative in gathering all the information about the arrests of a certain group of Israelis that were happening in the year 2000 and 2001. And this came from a report by the DEA. This is the foundation of the memorandum. It's that in 2000, there was this report by the DA about Israeli nationals selling art at the locations of the DA in places like Texas, Florida, Oklahoma, New York, New Jersey, all throughout the Southwest Northeast. And what happened was the memorandum shows that all these Israeli operatives that was acting as art students and that were using front moving companies were living just nearby all the 9/11 hijackers at the same time in the years 2000, 2001. So Gerald Shea put it in chronological order about who was involved with each ring, who was involved with each of these art students. And what they found was the leaders of these groups all have connections, not just to the Mossad, but also to army intelligence in Israel. Most of these people involved with this group, there was over 200 people. It's still considered the largest foreign intelligence ring ever operating on U.S. soil. Nobody knows about it. Everybody gets it mixed up because people like Rebecca Roth and Christopher Bowen want to say the art student ring was the people that were doing this crazy expose in the World Trade Center on the 83rd floor. Meanwhile, they're not even Israeli. And it was only like 8 people of them. And they wrote a book about this. They did a video about what they were doing. So they make this mistake saying that they're the art student ring. No, this art student ring was a much bigger ring and involved over 200 people that the Gerald Shea memorandums show their names involved because this guy went and got the arrest reports. What he did is miraculous. So he created this report, handed it to the 9/11 Commission and the Joint House Inquiry. Silence. Nobody wanted to touch it. And this report, this Gerald Shea memorandum that I'm covering in video format, basically shows that it involves so many people. And, you know, there's one guy, Hernan Sarfati, who's head of this group in Texas, and that was involved with infiltrating the DEA by selling art with listening devices in the art into the homes of these groups because the DEA.
This
was
is classic Mossad stuff.
Yeah, just remarkable. This is my favorite conspiracy of all regarding 9/11 because hardly ever nobody knows about it. And it's very rarely reported by anybody, even respected 9/11 researchers. And I'm trying to bring it to attention because I think people should know about it. So this is, yeah, it's my favorite conspiracy of all.
All right, we'll leave it there.
Cool.